Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, we turn an ear toward Turkey to hear about what some people are calling a deep state. It appears that some prison doors have been swinging open, and not everyone is happy about who is being freed. Then, we're off to India, where voters will soon be lining up for general elections. This time, many of those casting ballots will be young people who are becoming more and more politically involved. And near the end of our program, a bit of American history. We are here every day, and we give you our world, good or bad, as it is. People in Turkey are talking about the release of retired military officials and organized crime group members from prison. Some people say the release is a sign that the country's deep state could return. What exactly does that mean? Jonathan Evans answers the question.
Many were found guilty of crimes linked to what government lawyers have called deep state. They use deep state to describe unofficial organizations of power. Prosecutors have blamed such groups for targeted killings of political leaders or enemies of the state. Cengiz Aktar is with the Istanbul Policy Forum. He says the prisoner releases are troubling.
The Turkish public opinion is extremely worried now about these releases because these people might think of taking revenge in the months to come.
Among those released are people jailed for killing Hrant Dink, a leading Armenian reporter. Government lawyers say the killers of three religious workers were also released. Human rights groups say most deep state targets were activists fighting for the rights of Turkey's Kurdish minority. They say much of the violence took place during the 1990s. That is when Turkish forces repeatedly clashed with the Kurdish rebel group PKK. This month, Turkish nationalists attacked several offices of the People's Democracy Party. The group supports Kurdish rights. Ertuğrul Kürkçü is the leader of the People's Democracy Party. He believes the deep state organization was involved. He also thinks supporters of the group are responsible for past crimes against the Kurds. He and other observers say the government has released individuals linked to the deep state in an effort to defeat followers of an Islamic clergyman, Fethullah Gulen. The religious leader lives in self-imposed exile in the United States. The government accuses his followers of seeking to gain influence in Turkey's judiciary and police. Sinan Ulgin does not believe the government would take such a risky move. Mr. Ulgin is a visiting scholar with Carnegie Europe in Belgium. He blames the releases on the court system.
From the standpoint of the government, this was also an unwanted development because most of Turkish society is critical about this development. There has been a fundamental shift in the civil-military relationship, and that will not change.
Cengiz Aktar agrees that Turkey has changed since the military became directly involved in politics. But he says the country remains at risk for corruption.
the police and justice have been shaken and destabilized. Therefore, we don't know who will ensure the public order with that many criminals there in the street of the country.
Human rights groups accuse Turkey's deep state of thousands of political deaths and disappearances during the 1990s. I'm Jonathan Evans.
India is making final preparations for general elections. The voting begins next month. About 120 million Indians will be able to vote for the first time. Indians under the age of 25 are becoming more involved politically. They want leaders who will deal with issues like jobs and development. Karen Leggett takes the story from there.
In 2011, tens of thousands of young people joined anti-corruption protests in the center of India's capital, New Delhi. Sanjay Karwar was among the demonstrators. At the time, he was an engineering student at the Indian Institute of Technology. This year, he will be voting for the first time. But he wants to do more than mark a ballot. He wants to give his country a new direction. Sanjay Karwar is now working as a volunteer for the opposition Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP. He believes the party's candidate for prime minister would be able to deal with three issues of concern to young people. They are good governance, faster economic growth, and jobs. Thousands of college students like him have offered to help political parties in the election campaign. Voting for the 543 seats in Parliament begins on April 7th. India has the highest number of young people in the world. With a total population of 1.2 billion people, half are under 26 years old. Political parties largely ignored young people until they began protesting corruption and the gang rape of a student in Delhi in late 2012. Now, parties are seeking the support of these young voters. The ruling Congress Party hopes the image of its leading campaigner, Rahul Gandhi, will appeal to young voters. Mr. Gandhi is 43 years old. He has been pushing for younger candidates and speaking to young voters at campaign events. Ravi Shankar Prasad is a top leader of the BJP. He says his party's attention to development issues is important to young people. Political observers say the two main parties have failed to act on the concerns of young people. Sanjay Kumar is with the Center for Developing Societies in New Delhi. He wrote a book about Indian youth in politics. He says young Indians are showing more interest in politics than they did 10 years ago. Some of these young men and women want to become political leaders themselves. Others, like Sanjay Karwar, do not. Still, they are making time to campaign for their chosen parties. They organize meetings, actively use social media websites, and climb onto crowded trains to publicize their ideas before the elections. I'm Karen Leggett.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today is the birth date of the wonderful jazz singer Sarah Vaughan. She was born in Newark, New Jersey in 1924.
A lullaby of birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal it. in a phrase how I feel. Have you ever heard two turtle doves?
Don't forget, there are more Learning English programs still to come, and world news at the beginning of the hour. This is VOA.
When we kiss, and there's a weepy old willow, he really knows how to cry. That's how I cry.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. South Africa has 11 official languages. If you want to say hello, it's Sawubona in Zulu and hallo in Afrikaans. Now, South Africa's school children may start using ni hao to say hello. The country's education minister says the nation is adding the Mandarin language teaching in some schools. Mandarin is the official spoken language of China. That country is a major trading power for South Africa. A recent agreement between the two nations centers on five areas of cooperation. They include development in basic education, school books and lessons, mathematics and science, teacher training, and career education and research. South African officials have not said how much the teaching Mandarin will cost. Troy Martens is an official with South Africa's Ministry of Basic Education. She says the new partnership is extremely valuable.
So it's very exciting, and both countries have indicated that for them education is a high priority, and that's why education is high on the agenda of collaboration between the two countries.
The part of the plan that has gained the most attention is the inclusion of the Mandarin language in schools. A public opinion study last year found that South Africans have mixed feelings about China. The survey showed 46% of South Africans do not like the spread of Chinese ideas and customs in their country. The results also showed that 60% dislike Chinese music, movies, and television. But Ms. Martin said Chinese trade is more important than those feelings. She said it is extremely helpful to learners in South Africa to study Mandarin as well as Chinese culture. And she said not every school will offer Mandarin.
Now, this won't be compulsory, it won't be for every school, and it won't be for every child. But for schools that feel they have the capacity to offer Mandarin as a subject, we think it's a great opportunity for South African learners to be exposed to, you know, this international type of language.
South Africa's population studies do not say how many native Chinese speakers are among its nearly 51 million people. Lisette Noonan heads the 80-year-old Pretoria Chinese School in South Africa's capital. The school serves about 500 students from kindergarten to grade 12. Every student studies Mandarin. Ms. Noonan says the school welcomes the new cooperation between South Africa and China. She said it is in the best interests of children to study Mandarin. She said that is especially true with China becoming what she called a huge economic power in the world. South African schools suffer from the country's history of apartheid. And from VOA Learning English, that's the Education Report. I'm Bob Doty.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the election of Martin Van Buren as the 8th President of the United States. Van Buren had served as President Andrew Jackson's Secretary of State and later his Vice President. Jackson asked his political party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. The Whig Party was against him, but their opposition was divided. Van Buren won the election easily. Jackson stood beside Van Buren as the new president was sworn in at the Capitol building in Washington. Physically, the two men were very different. Jackson was tall, with long white hair that flowed back over his head. Jackson's health had been poor during the last few months he spent in the White House. He seemed tired. There was almost no color in his face. Van Buren was much shorter than Jackson and had much less hair. His eyes were brighter than those of the old man next to him. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren noted that he was the first American born after the Revolution to become President of the United States. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His family was Dutch. Van Buren said he felt he belonged to a later age. He called for more unity among Democrats of the North and South. He said better times were ahead for the country. Martin Van Buren had a poor education as a boy. He went to school only for a few years. His father was a farmer and hotel keeper at a small town in New York State. Politicians, including Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, had sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them and others, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended tenants and renters who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official and then a senator and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with. But she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with 4 sons.
And after that, he was known as quite charming among the ladies, as they said in those days.
Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. Mr. Silby says, most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his political life and his social life separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. But he did not have a national reputation like Andrew Jackson had.
What he was known for and what got him into the vice presidency and then the presidency was that he was Jackson's right-hand man.
Van Buren had been president for just a few days when an economic crisis struck the country. The crisis had been building for months. It really began with the death of the Bank of the United States more than a year before. The bank had been so strong that it was able to control the economy throughout most of the country. It also helped control smaller state banks. It refused to accept the notes or paper money of these banks unless the state banks could exchange the paper for gold or silver money. President Jackson had opposed the Bank of the United States. He vetoed a bill that would have continued it. After the powerful bank closed, a number of new state banks opened. All of them produced large amounts of paper money, many times the amount they could exchange for gold or silver. Business speculators used much of this paper money to buy land from the government. These men bought the land, held it for a while, then sold it for more than they paid. The government soon found itself with millions of dollars of paper money of questionable value. To stop these activities, Jackson had ordered only gold or silver payments for government land. But many banks did not have enough gold to cover the paper notes. At the same time, American agriculture was having trouble. In 1835 and 1837, many crops failed. American traders had to import farm products from Europe, and they had to pay for them in gold or silver. In the spring of 1837, just as Martin Van Buren was taking office, the demand on banks for gold and silver grew too heavy. The banks stopped honoring their promises to exchange their paper money for gold. They said the suspension was just temporary, that it was necessary to stop for a while all payments in gold or silver. The crisis became worse. Many of the weaker state banks closed. Those that stayed open had almost no money to lend. Businessmen could not pay back money they owed the banks, and they could not get loans to keep their businesses open. Many factories closed. Great numbers of people were out of work, and prices rose higher and higher. Most people struggled to buy food and other necessities. The price of flour and meat doubled between 1835 and 1837. Even coal, the fuel people used to heat their homes, cost two times as much. Violence finally broke out at a protest meeting in New York City. Some in the crowd demanded action against the rich traders. About 1,000 people marched to a store, forced their way into it, and destroyed large amounts of flour and grain. Businessmen blamed the government for the economic depression. They said the biggest reason was a decision former President Jackson made. Jackson's order required the government to accept only gold or silver for government land. Opponents said the order had caused fear and mistrust. Even some of Jackson's strongest supporters said it should be lifted. They said the measure had done its job of ending land speculation. Now, they said, it was hurting the economy. Two of President Van Buren's closest advisors urged him to continue the order. Lifting it, they argued, would flood the federal government with worthless paper money. Van Buren was troubled. The federal government had already lost $9 million because of bank failures. The president wanted to make sure the government had enough money, and he wanted this money safe until needed. Yet, he did not believe the federal government had the responsibility for ending the Depression. And historian Joel Silby says Van Buren did not believe the government had the right to interfere in any way with private business.
He said that over and over again, that the federal government doesn't have the power to do this.
Mr. Silby adds that Van Buren's political philosophy grew out of the beliefs of former President Thomas Jefferson. All of his life, Van Buren claimed to be a Jeffersonian Democrat.
That had very specific meaning to him. Limited government, freedom for people, meaning white males. He was an egalitarian within the limits of those years.
Van Buren also shared Jackson's suspicion of bankers. In general, he believed no group, neither the government nor the wealthy, should have too much power, not even to help the economy. So Van Buren decided to continue Jackson's order. No government land could be bought with paper money. The American economy got worse. The president called a special meeting of Congress. In a message to lawmakers, Van Buren said, "Overbanking and overtrading had caused the Depression." He proposed several steps to protect the government. One of them was for Congress to pass a law permitting the government to keep its own money in the Treasury. America's Treasury Department received money when it collected import taxes and sold land. It used this money to pay what the government owed. The Treasury did not, however, hold the money from the time it was collected to the time it was paid out. The Treasury put the money in private banks. President Van Buren wanted to end this custom. He wanted a law to let the Treasury keep government money in its own secure places. The Whigs criticized Van Buren for thinking only of protecting the federal government and not helping businessmen, farmers, and the states. Some Democrats, who believed strongly in states' rights, also opposed Van Buren's idea. His opponents provided enough votes in Congress to defeat the proposal. Van Buren tried again the following year to get approval for an independent treasury. Again, the proposal was defeated. Finally, in June 1840, Congress passed a law enabling the Treasury Department to hold government money itself. Van Buren signed what was called the Independent Treasury Bill. But the economic depression continued. Martin Van Buren also faced an international challenge from a surprising place. The president's troubles with Canada will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.